Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. I'm coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C. And also, South Africa's ANC may lose its parliamentary majority in the national elections.
The collapse of the ANC vote has taken a lot of people by surprise. I think even more surprising is the massive number of votes that Jacob Zuma's Umkhonto Wesizwe party has taken.
Nigeria's information minister says reforms undertaken by President Bola Ahmed Tinubu are necessary to move the country forward.
I think that there is a consensus among the political class that for us to develop, subsidy had to go. And the president was courageous enough to have done that. Did this have any some shocks and some impact? Yes, absolutely. The government did anticipate that. And when the impact began to be felt, the government also rolled out a number of measures to cushion that.
And Malawi establishes a financial crimes court to combat corruption.
Through an act of parliament, we amended the Courts Act to create a financial crimes division of the High Court. So this court is a division of the High Court, but it is specifically only for financial crimes, which includes corruption cases.
Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. With 99% of the vote counted in South Africa's election, it appeared today that African National Congress, which led the government since the first democratic vote in 1994, has lost its majority. The latest figures from vote counting in Wednesday's election show the ANC won about 40% of the vote. Its nearest competitor, the Democratic Alliance, had about 21%. In the coming days, the ANC expected to negotiate with opposition parties to form a coalition government. David Everard, a professor at the School of Governance at the Wits University in Johannesburg, says the performance of the Umkhonto Wesizwe, or MK party, in the elections has shocked political parties across South Africa. Led by former President Jacob Zuma, the Umkhonto Wesizwe performed well in the KwaZulu-Natal province, where the party is projected to reach at least 50% of the vote. The tallies today indicate nationally MK came in third place with about 14% of the vote. Analysts say the new party appears to have taken significant votes from the ANC and the opposition, the Economic Freedom Fighters, or the EFF. For analysis and the latest political development, I read Professor David Everard.
People are somewhat shocked. The collapse of the ANC vote has taken a lot of people by surprise. I think even more surprising is the massive number of votes that Jacob Zuma's Umkhonto Wesizwe party has taken. It's now easily the third strongest party in the country and looks like being almost at 50% in KwaZulu-Natal. And that has really shaken up the political scene almost completely. No party has ever, you know, come on the scene from zero with about 4 or 5 months of existence and taken 10% of the vote. It's just unheard of. So I think a mix of the ANC collapsing to what looks like it'll be at best 42%, which the polls had predicted, but as ever, no one listens to pollsters. And then the rise of MK, and MK then taking votes from the EFF, taking votes from Inkatha, probably taking ANC votes. It really has changed the political balances quite strongly.
Do you think the political parties, including the ANC, the EFF, and even the DA, are shocked by the performance of the Umkhonto Wesizwe party?
Oh, I think they're completely shocked, sidewound, whatever you want to get sidewinded. Everything. Everyone knew it was coming. Because, you know, the old man made, Zuma made a lot of fuss about the party. It got very high media profile. But I think most people thought it would be a disgruntled rump of former ANC voters in KwaZulu-Natal maybe getting 5 or 10% in KwaZulu-Natal, but not featuring really anywhere very strongly. And it has changed everyone's arithmetic in one fell swoop.
I heard some ANC spokespeople talking about a possible alliance, coalition alliance, to form the next government in the interest of the people or the country. They said the Democratic Alliance has also made a similar statement. Is this obvious that this is the way to go?
No, not at all. I mean, I think different parts of the ANC are doing different calculations. I think the dominant faction, the Ramaphosa faction, which will certainly have an eye on the markets, which have really punished us during the election, that faction would probably say ANC plus Democratic Alliance plus Inkatha, we make 50%, we can govern. That'll stabilize the markets. And to be honest, the DA is not going to out-strategize the ANC. You know, they'll keep each other at arm's length, and there's no risk to the ANC politically. Another faction will be saying, no, we need to go into an alliance with the EFF, which by itself is not enough because MK has taken so many EFF votes. And so maybe we bring in MK as well. And the argument there, which is quite a remarkable argument, is that the EFF was originally born out of the ANC, and MK is obviously led by the former ANC president. Therefore, we're all Congress together, and we can claim this as an election victory for Congress. I think that's currently the minority voice. I think it's clear that were that to happen, the economic damage would be enormous. But it's nonetheless there, and it's certainly an option depending on the balance of forces inside the ANC.
Professor Everard, during the compilation of the vote, there were some technical challenges experienced by the Independent Electoral Commission that, you know, attracted criticism of incompetence, of voter tampering, of rigging, perhaps. Are these accusations or criticisms legitimate?
I don't think there is any grounds for claiming that there was vote rigging. I think what happened to the Independent Electoral Commission, the IEC, it had its budget slashed by the government. It lost 280 million rand. And then got told to run the most complicated election it ever had to do with three ballot papers, not two. And it battled without question. But I think it was a question of capacity, not one of any underhand activities.
David Everard is a professor at the School of Governance at the Wits University in Johannesburg. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. The Electoral Commission had said before the election it expected to announce final results on Sunday. Nigeria's information minister says reforms undertaken by President Bola Ahmed Tinubu were necessary to move the country forward. Mohammed Idris also says Nigerians will soon see the benefits of the implemented policies, which he adds will improve the lives of citizens and boost both local and international investor confidence. His remarks come as the administration marks a year since the president took power on May 29, 2023. But critics say reforms, including the removal of fuel subsidies, are increasing inflation and food prices. For an assessment of the performance of the administration after 1 year in office, I reached Information Minister Mohammed Idris via video link. Here is part one of the conversation.
The president took office about a year ago, and he instituted a number of reforms, very far-reaching reforms. I recall that at the onset of the administration, he took away fuel subsidy, which was eating very deep into our revenues. So he decided that the fuel subsidy had to go so that more revenues can be available for Nigerians to feel the impact of governance. You know, so some of the funds taken away from those subsidies were put into education or put into healthcare. You've seen what we are doing in agriculture. So I think there are very far-reaching reforms. Second, there was also this unification of our currency. I recall that before last year, there were multiple exchange rates in this country. The central bank was having a lot of problem, you know, finalizing which address to use. So the president said that is not acceptable. Of course, the central bank is completely independent, but they had the the political backing to do whatever they wanted to do to make our economy very straight. So they also did that reform. Today I can tell you that we have one exchange rate. Of course, that is leading to some kind of fluctuation of the value of the naira itself. But we think that that is normal. It is to be expected. We believe that sooner than later, naira will have its value, and then investors' confidence can be boosted, and then people can do more planning for their businesses.
Some of the reforms carried out is having some impact, not so good. Some of your critics say. They said the removal of subsidies is creating a lot of hardship among public sector workers. They are even threatening to embark on strike and all that. Was this reforms, or were these reforms really necessary at this time? Because some people had suggested that perhaps a piecemeal approach to carry Nigerians along, and that this was too drastic of a change, which is having a devastating impact on the ordinary Nigerian, making Nigerians poorer. How do you respond to that, Mr. Information Minister?
These reforms are absolutely necessary. I want you to go back to June or to May 29 when the president took office. Recall that the subsidy provision in the budget of 2023, there was no provision after June of last year. And that's one. Two, all the major political opponents of the president, rivals, all of them had promised that they were also going to do the same thing. So I think that there is a consensus among the political class that for us to develop, subsidy had to go. And the president was courageous enough to have done that. Did this have any some shocks and some impact? Yes, absolutely. I don't think that the government didn't expect that it will have some impact. The government did anticipate that. And when the impact began to be felt, the government also rolled out a number of measures to cushion that.
What about the issue of insecurity? Because there have been a lot of reports in the local media about kidnappings, gross insecurity increases, especially in the capital, Abuja, and parts of the north.
Well, again, we have to go back again before the administration came into being. It is almost impossible, for example, to move from the nation's capital, Abuja, to other parts of the north, like Kaduna and Kano and Katsina and Sokoto. It was becoming extremely difficult because kidnappers were stopping their motorists on the highway, kidnapping them, snatching them in some instances, killing them and maiming them, collecting ransoms from them when they are kidnapped and the families want to get them released. So yes, absolutely true, there was kidnapping. But of course, that has drastically gone down. You can move freely now from Abuja to Kaduna, to Kano, to other parts, especially of the northern part of the country. And when you said that there's insecurity in Abuja, Abuja is largely safe now. A couple of months ago, we had some disturbing incidents around the nation's capital, but the government was very proactive. It went straight into the matter. And I can tell you that that has significantly calmed down now. Now, government is not in any way saying that we are where we want to be in terms of our security, but I think there has been a gradual return to normalcy. And also know that before this time, ransom that used to facilitate these kidnappers continuing their businesses have been stopped by government. It is the position of government now that nobody is going to be paid for no kidnapper will be paid to have anyone released. So the security agencies have honed up their own strategies. They've employed new tactics of ensuring that kidnappers are brought back in safety to their homes without paying ransom. Recall that the school children in Kaduna, for example, that happened a couple of months, 2 or 3 months back. You see how the government decisively dealt with the matter, and all of them were returned home to their parents in safety.
Mohammed Idris is Nigeria's information minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation. Nigeria's leading labor groups, the Trade Union Congress and the National Labor Congress, plan to kick off an indefinite nationwide strike on Monday. The unions say the government's offer of a 60,000 naira monthly minimum wage, or about $45, is insufficient. Former U.S. President Donald Trump vowed to appeal his guilty verdict a day after a jury of New York citizens convicted him of all 34 felony counts of attempting to illegally influence the outcome of the 2016 national election. On Friday, Trump delivered a list of grievances about the case, the country, and President Joe Biden. Trump claimed without evidence that the judge in his case was biased and unfair, and that the New York State legal proceedings were orchestrated by Biden and federal officials. Under the U.S. system, state courts operate independently of the national government and federal legal system. Trump also alleged that a chief witness against him, his former attorney Michael Cohen, lied. Cohen earlier served a prison sentence after being convicted on charges related to the Trump case. For analysis on how some Africans see the former president's conviction and reaction, I spoke with Dr. James Jonah. He is a former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
Trump has gone with the idea for a long time that he's immune. And he himself said it and said, I can kill somebody, that will happen to me. Take the case of Cohen, who was his lawyer for a long time, a man who really believed in Trump and said many times that he would take a shot to protect Trump. Okay, he arranged this thing, you know, because it was clear. In the late days of the election, after the Hollywood tape, any other expose would have destroyed him. That is the background. And therefore, he decided to kill the story.
The question that people are asking is, this is the first time in America's history to have a former presidential candidate being convicted of crimes. And they said they see these in developing countries, majority of them in Africa and Asia, where these are seen. And this, they said, sets a very dangerous precedent. How does an African look at this?
Well, in fact, what you have a case under Nixon, his vice president actually was indicted. Okay, he had to resign. And Nixon would have been indicted if he had not been pardoned by the man who succeeded him. And that has been severely criticized throughout. But yes, in America, it is unprecedented. But if you look around the world, look at Europe. In France, I think they have indicted about three or four of their presidents. The same thing in Italy. It's only in America where there has been this kind of taboo. But it's nothing impossible.
The question a lot of people also ask is, this could have an impact on the coming election in America in November. And they said, usually incumbent presidents, specifically in Africa, use some of these charges to go after their political opponents to weaken them ahead of the vote. Is this what we are seeing here in America?
No, it's going to be the reverse. Because there's a good deal of prejudice. The fact that another general in New York is a black man, that they found, why is he doing that? They're racist. Why? This is not anything where you should drag somebody to the court. But on the case with Mr. Smith, who deals with the Congress invasion, they think what he's doing is the best thing. Even the woman in Georgia, they say, who is she? This is the background. So what they have been trying to do is whenever Trump gets into trouble, like the indictment, you will see that his ability to raise funds will increase dramatically. Okay. And even in the polls, he will rise. But this might be just trying to make make look good. But I don't know what will happen if on the 11th of July he is sentenced and few days later he is confirmed as the presidential candidate of the Republicans. This will be a a totally negative for the American political class. But how long could you want somebody to be so immune? So to me, this is a test for the Western concept of the rule of law. Not talk, but the rule of law. And why should they expect that Mr. Cohen should send to jail for 3 years and yet allow Mr. Trump to go free?
Dr. James Jonah is a former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. He spoke with me from New York. Former president of the Sierra Leone Bar Association are calling for a rerun of the recent leadership election of the group. Francis Gabidon, a former association president who has been practicing law for 51 years, says the controversy surrounding the poll tarnishes the image of the law association both domestically and internationally. His remarks come after the former president of the Bar Association signed a joint letter calling for a repeat of the poll. For more about the call, I reach Francis Gabidon.
About nine of us who were past presidents at one time of the Sierra Leone Bar Association put out a statement as we were not happy with what took place at Kenema.
Why were you not happy
with what? Well, we were not happy because of what happened. I mean, we normally have a program which we follow every year, and on this occasion, they did not comply with it. For example, all the different people in the executive should give their reports. The treasurer, the secretary, assistant treasurer, so that you have a brief summary of what's taking place in the past before you have the new elections now to have the new members. That was not done. Instead, the rush to have elections, which created a lot of problems, and ballot papers were being thrown on the floor. So they did not comply with the normal agenda. And because of this, it creates a lot of problems.
So as past president, are you engaging with the organization and the lawyers involved to try to bring some form of normalcy?
Not personally. As a group, we've put forward a position paper, and the different groups that are involved in this, we expect to meet them and tell them how we think these things should be done. Because we used to have this conference every year, and we have an agenda which we follow. That is, we have speeches by the Attorney General, President of the Bar Association. Then we go to the reports of the past executive to tell us what and what they've been doing. And eventually we get elections of new members. And we have a program which we've followed for years now. And since we've been following it, we've never had any problems. But when they went to Kenema this time, they changed the whole thing. It created a lot of problems.
So do you think by rerunning the elections, that will resolve a majority of the problems that exist now?
I don't think so. I don't know whether it's resolved. It was just an option, one of the options we thought we can put forward to see if that can help. But they're not bound to do it. But I don't know which other way they do things again to satisfy the majority, because a lot of people were not able to cast their votes. If you look at the results, you see somebody having 500 and something, then the others 20-something. It's not possible, because we know the different figures that were available all over the place. And if they don't have what are called reasonable figures, there is something fundamentally wrong. Because a lot of people, those who are the students, I mean, the guys who are coming from Bo and from Freetown, said that as soon as they were coming, a lorry broke down deliberately, they said, with logs on the street. They could not access the street. So a lot of them, by the time they were getting to Panama, the elections was over. And they are saying that it was deliberate, that they could not get access to Panama.
But do you think the controversy surrounding the election will tarnish the Bar Association itself following this?
Oh,
because
yes.
People are displeased.
Oh, yes. Our reputation has now been tarnished, not just locally, internationally as well. Colleagues of mine who are in England, who I studied with, they all called me and say, What are we hearing about asylum rushes? One of the oldest in Africa, with a big reputation. It has already tarnished it. So we have to find ways and means to minimize the damage that has been done.
What advice will you give organizers of this event in order to right the wrong?
Well, one advice I'll give the candidates is, first of all, they must realize that what they're going in for is for service, to serve their fellow colleagues at the bar. It's not as a platform for politics or any other form of ambition they have. I think that's one. Number two, I think they should shy away from the politicians with money, because there is evidence that on both sides of three sides, money changing hands. And if they come in as just lawyers who are interested in serving their fellow colleagues, irrespective of their politics or ideology, to see that they really are well looked after, I don't think that should be a problem.
Francis Gabidon is a former president of the Sierra Leone Bar Association. He spoke with me from the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown. I attempted for more than a week to interview the winner of the Bar Association election, Tuma Adama Jabi, but she has not responded. Malawi's Constitutional Affairs and Justice Minister is expressing excitement over the launch of the Financial Crimes Court in the capital, Lilongwe. Titus Mvalu says the establishment of the court demonstrates the administration's commitment to the fight against corruption and financial malfeasance. His remarks come after the official opening of the Financial Crimes Division of the Malawi High Court. The court, the Justice and Constitutional Affairs Minister says, will deal with financial crimes and seeks to expedite trial of the financial and corruption cases and ensure justice. However, critics say the court could be used to persecute political opponents of the administration. Titus Mvalu tells me the independence of the judiciary is protected by the Constitution.
Well, I'm very excited about this court being established. As you may be aware, we started talking about this court in May of 2022, where I made an announcement that a government is planning to establish a special court to handle financial crimes. At that time, the president of Malawi, Dr. Lazarus Makathe Chakwera, had instructed me to see a way of establishing this court. And so we established this court in the same 2022 through an act of parliament. We amended the Courts Act to create a financial crimes division of the High Court. So this court is a division of the High Court, but it is specifically only for financial crimes, which include corruption cases.
Talking about the Financial Crimes Court, how independent will this be in terms of not coming under undue political pressure to be used, so to speak, to go after political opponents?
No. As I said, this court is a part of the High Court. And the Constitution of Malawi says that all courts and judicial officers who preside over cases shall be independent of influence from any political or any other office. So this court will equally be protected by the Constitution in terms of its independence.
How will this help in the fight against corruption?
The major role that we envisage for this particular special court is that it will help in expediting the trial and the conclusion of cases that involve financial crimes. At the moment, we have been having a problem because the same courts, like High Court General Division, Criminal Division, it tries all criminal cases. So sometimes you find that corruption cases are not given a priority because they're just part of the several other types of cases that the court is trying. But this particular court will deal with nothing else except financial crimes. So therefore, we expect that there will be speed in disposal of financial crimes cases. But also, the other thing that we expect to develop along the way is that there will be specialization of judges, because these judges of this court will be dealing with financial crimes. And we know that financial crimes have become these days very complicated. They can be very complex in the way they're committed. So they'll go through some training to prepare them, to equip them with skills to handle financial crimes. And therefore, we expect that they will be specialized and therefore be able to deal with matters of this nature quickly.
What should be the expectations of Malawi?
Well, Malawians should expect, as I've been saying, they should expect a more serious approach in the way these cases are handled by a special court and special and judges that are specifically dealing with these cases. We expect to have a more effective and a more efficient and speedier conclusion of financial crimes cases in this court.
Would there be a construction of an edifice to host this special crimes court?
Ideally, yes, that's what we would have to happen, and that's what we expect to happen. But you see, financial resources are a problem. So at the moment, they're using the same infrastructure that other courts are using, which is not a deal situation. But you may be aware that the government of Malawi has one of its flagship projects in construction of a judicial complex within the city center in Lilongwe. And that complex will have around 40 courtrooms. So some courtrooms can be allocated to this financial division so that they have their own courts carved out of that complex as the courts for the financial crimes courts. But we also expect, would like ideally to have this court not just here in the Lilongwe capital city, but also in other regions of the country. The regional headquarters is in Zuzu in the north, and also in Blantyre should have also an infrastructure to house the financial crimes courts. And also in the eastern division of the country, in Zomba, the former capital city of Malawi, should also, it's in the plans that they should also have their own infrastructure for this court.
Titus Mvalo is Malawi's Constitutional Affairs and Justice Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Zambia, the executive director at Center for Policy Dialogue says concerns about rising political tension in the southern African country is legitimate and must be addressed. Dr. Neo Simutani, who is also an independent political analyst, says attempts by state institutions, including the police, to prevent opposition groups from engaging in political activities are to blame for the rising tension. This, as supporters of the administration and opposition leaders trade accusations of hate speech and intolerance. Some worried Zambians say that if not quickly addressed, the tension could spiral into violence. For analysis and the latest development, I reach Dr. Neo Simutani.
The level of intolerance, I think, is what is rising. These things have been happening even under the previous regime of Edgar Lungu. The things people have been arrested for used to take place. People made those kind of statements and they're not arrested. What is, I think, has changed now is that people who are saying these things are perceived to be doing so to mobilize public opinion or public sentiment against the state.
But
because
isn't it what politics is all about?
Yes. So what is being said is not necessarily untrue. It's because you see, when you talk about hate speech, you are saying people, what they are saying is unfounded. That is not necessarily the case. Because under Edgar Lungu, people complained that the government was tilted towards the north. Member speakers or those who came from Eastern Province altogether, and that some groups, areas of the regions of the country were excluded, including Southern Province. They are not saying the same thing, but this time it's being said by those who were previously in power. And they are saying so to complain that the government is dominated by Tonga speakers. Now, that's actually true. The only thing is that it's being interpreted as aimed at influencing people to rise against the state. it's being interpreted to mean these people don't mean well. They hate Tonga speakers and so forth.
Do you think allowing opposition political groupings or critics of the administration to meet freely as guaranteed by the Constitution will ease some of these political intolerance that many people are attributing to the rising political tension in Zambia?
Yes, indeed, indeed. In fact, I've talked about that several times in the last few weeks. The issue is this. President Hichilema himself was not allowed to hold public meetings. He was prevented from addressing public rallies in Lusaka and Kwabelt mainly. And we expected that when there's a change of government, what he was subjected to, what UPND was subjected to, won't be repeated. So the disappointment is that what the current regime went through is being replicated. You see, that is not what the election was about. Hichilema won by 59-something%, almost 60% of the vote. He got an overwhelming majority. And what people were saying by rejecting the Patriotic Front was that he should correct what was happening under the Patriotic Front. So we expected that when there's change of government, the UPND government will not repeat what we didn't like about Chile, about Lungu's presidency. But he's doing the same. It's not worse. You see? So why should the opposition not be allowed to hold rallies? Eh? Why? And because they aren't allowed to hold rallies, when they have these press conferences of theirs and say things which are critical of the government, they say they are insulting the state, the government, they're insulting the president, they say they're inciting people to rise against the government, and they use that hate speech. So really, detaining 5-6 people who are outspoken is unprecedented. You see, what is happening, you arrest members of parliament, you arrest your leaders of opposition parties, all because they are saying that the government excludes particular groups of people. But what they are saying is true. So why should it be a crime? And in any case, even if it's not true, why the freedom of speech? Why should not? But the issue is that government has an opportunity to answer back if they are being accused of segregating particular groups of people, particular tribes. They can answer back. They can give evidence. They can show.
Dr. Neo Simutanyi is the executive director at Center for Policy Dialogue and an independent political analyst. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Zambia's government has repeatedly denied that it is trying to block opposition groups. The police say they are only protecting law and order. In Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, pro-democracy groups, including the Swaziland People's Liberation Movement, or SPLM, are calling on invited artists and revelers to boycott Sunday's bushfire festival. Vusi Shongwe, the founder and president of the SPLM, says the call forms part of the move to pressure the Southern African Kingdom to allow citizens to choose their own leaders in a democracy. It comes after the SPLM teamed up with pro-democracy groups to petition invited artists who are to perform during the bushfire festival not to visit the kingdom, citing human rights abuses and lack of democracy. But supporters of the administration in Imbabani rejected the criticism. They say this is an attempt by activists to tarnish the image of the country and to undermine an event that unifies the country. For more about the calls for boycott, I read Vusi Shongwe.
The SPLM has joined SSN Southern Solidarity Network and the MSS in petitioning artists that are coming from the African continent, from the region, and also from across the African continent and beyond our borders, as in overseas, to ask them not to participate in the forthcoming bushfire festival that is taking place this weekend in Swaziland. The reason for our call is is to ask them to observe the ongoing cultural boycott that was started in 2012, whereby we're petitioning artists not to come to Swaziland as a way of forcing the Swazi government to democratize. So the reason why we're asking these artists not to come is to make them aware, to say, by participating in this event, they are actually abating the Swazi government into perpetuating the misrule that is currently taking place in Swaziland. So for that reason, we feel that the Bushfire Festival is nothing but a propaganda festival by the Muswati regime.
What responses have you gotten so far since you petitioned these artists?
After writing letters to them and their promoters, we have received a number of calls and emails from some of them to say that if they had known earlier, they wouldn't have taken up the invitation. Some have even pointed out that they've even taken the deposits for them to come and participate. But they've now given us an assurance that they are not going to be participating in next year's event. Another feedback that we have received is from the different organizations across the region, in the Southern African region in particular, to ask for their support in terms of escalating and amplifying this voice for the cultural boycotts to be spread across the region. Because most of the participants to these events, they come from the Republic of South Africa, some come from Lesotho, Botswana, Mozambique, and other countries in the Southern African region.
What impact do you think this boycott is going to have? Because some citizens I spoke with are saying this is yet another attempt to destabilize the country and to tarnish the reputation of the government and by extension the king.
It is very unfortunate for people to think that way. First of all, let me just answer the issue of the impact. The impact that we hope and we know that it is going to get for the struggle in Swaziland is that, for starters, one of our key pillars in the struggle is international solidarity. International solidarity in us as the people of Swaziland, amplifying the calls and also making people aware from across the globe of the pain and suffering that we're suffering as the people of Swaziland. So this is a way for us loudening the calls for the international community to come and assist us in Swaziland in terms of coercing the Muswati regime to heed the calls for democratization to take place in Swaziland. We take stock from what happened even during the apartheid years in South Africa, when the international community stood in one voice in what was known as the anti-apartheid movement, whereby international events were organized and people were made aware of the evils that were taking place in South Africa. So we're using that as our learning curve to say this is what others that have been through the same journey that we have been, I mean, that we're currently in, to say let us use some of the strategies that they used. And then in terms of those that are saying that it is aimed at tarnishing the image of the country and of the king, it is very unfortunate and actually self-delusional for those people. Actually, those that are saying that were saying that was such people and such elements, they are people that are benefiting from the status quo. It doesn't matter whether they are Swazi or external forces, because we all know that Swaziland remains an outpost of the only undemocratic state in the southern region. So there is nothing called the uniquely Swazi democracy. So ours, as part of this program, we have highlighted the key points why we are staging the cultural boycott, to also make people that might not be aware of what is happening in Swaziland to be aware of what the people of Swaziland are going through on a day-to-day basis. So using the anti-bushfire cultural boycott, we are using that because it is an international event in terms of the number of people that it attracts from across the globe and from across the African continent, to highlight the plight of the people of Swaziland that they are suffering under the noose of King Mswati, his family and his regime.
Vusi Shongwe is the founder and president of the Swaziland People's Liberation Movement, or SPLM. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. International human rights groups, the European Union and other governments have criticized the Swatini's government for its suppression of critics and alleged human rights abuses. The government of King Mswati III, who rules as an absolute monarch, has rejected those criticisms as unfounded.
The SPLM has joined.
And right now it's time for music from African Collection.
Marius Bayundela.
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Impuga and engineer the great Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if you want to move mountains tomorrow, you must start removing stones today. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.
Baby, c'est automatique.